You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Chrissy Iles, the Anne and Joel Ehrenkranz Curator at the Whitney Museum of American Art. Chrissy, thanks so much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
To begin with, let's talk a little bit about what you're working on now, current show at the Whitney, or what you're curating. What is it that you're involved with at the moment?
I just opened a show of T.J. Wilcox, and he commissioned, I commissioned, a large-scale projective panoramic film installation called In the Air, which occupies the whole second floor of the gallery. And what it is a huge circular screen, 360 degrees, that you duck under to get inside. And TJ has a studio on the northwest corner of Union Square, and it's right on top of a building, and it has windows all around. It's a little janitor's apartment. And he made the piece inspired by all the views he could see around from his studio, and the fact that New York is really like a kind of stage on which endless stories are played out. Every street corner, every building, you know, New York is so iconic for that. So what he did was he filmed one day in New York City from sunrise to sunset, and then he speeded it up to 30 minutes. And then as you're watching this this kind of speeded up temporal shift in the light, he interrupts the narrative of the panorama with almost like a clock, one, then another, going all the way around, a little film. Each one is 3 minutes, and each one is a little vignette of a kind of story that's a combination of fantasy and reality and things that he's interested in that he sees from his window. For example, he can see Warhol's factory, where Warhol had his studio, from the kind of northeast corner, so there's a little vignette about that. Gloria Vanderbilt's apartment is kind of further over, and he has a little vignette about her. Directly south is the World Trade Center site, and so there's one little film where his super, who was up there on the roof at the time, talks about his experience of that, and so on, and it goes around. And then the final one is a little sunset, Manhattanhenge, which happens in the summer, where you can see the sun go down between the buildings, you know, in one of the cross streets. And that last film occurs just as the sun's going down on the whole panorama. So I think it's really fantastic to, A, do a show where it's one big piece commissioned. You don't know what you're going to get till you open the show, but I'm a risk taker, so I like that. Mm. And also, I think because the internet is so absorbed by all of us now, and the screen of the internet and our iPhones and everything else and iPad is just, you know, something we check every 10 seconds, some of us. There's a renewed interest by people in wanting something that's both material, maybe communal, where people are gathered together physically in one space, and maybe spectacular in a way that's opposite to the screen, which is unspectacular and kind of banal and full of great information, but it's very small, relatively speaking. And so I think one of the reasons this panorama has captured everyone's hearts, because it's very popular, is because it takes us back to a sense of something beyond ourselves.
We were just briefly interrupted by a technological glitch, which was interesting because we're talking about the exhibition of T.J. Wilcox, and as you were describing, you know, the kind of culture that we're now in with iPads and phones and checking them all the time, to commission one large show with one kind of very unique experience, which to me, as you were saying, is about communities, but is also kind of a love letter to New York, it seems to me, in a bit, but also in terms of how we're all looking at visual data, media. This show gives us, at the very least, something very different, a different way of looking at at media, at the world, at video, which we're also consumed with on our small phones and devices.
Yeah, and it's interesting because on the small device, the screen is as big as your hand. In this panorama, you're surrounded by an image, and it unfolds over half an hour, which is quite a long time for people to sit around, even though the actual footage is speeded up and it's actually from sunrise to sunset. So, you know, you've got a very interesting situation where people don't normally sit and watch the entire day unfold over time like that through light. It's speeded up so that we can watch it over half an hour, and we sort of understand the arc of time that way. And it's already much longer than we'd spend sitting in a gallery watching most things. So I think the way in which he deals with time is very interesting. I also think that because everyone's Instagramming everything all the time, everything's seen in fragments. So images are understood in the city, or every experience is understood through fragments. And this is bringing us back to a kind of more architectural, physical, large-scale, enveloping kind of experiential understanding of the image. The image is 360 degrees, 35 feet wide, but it's not a commercial image, which is what images that size almost always are. And I think it's interesting that when you think about technology and artists, artists have always used technology as a tool. So the moment a new piece of technology comes in, the artist will engage with it and transform something with it. And that was true when the moving and still camera appeared in the 19th century. It's true at the beginning. I think I was mentioning this big panorama in 1901, shot with 16mm cameras, 12 of them, and then they were projected to create this panoramic image with this big, big, big circular screen in the World's Fair in Paris. Obviously, the image would have been a lot more collaged together and unevenly stitched together because there was not the technology we have now. But this instinct to use technology to create something that's maybe about our environmental nature but removed from it. It's almost like when painters use a mirror to look at reality. A lot of painters of all hues, they look through the mirror when they're painting. They have a mirror to the side of their canvas, and it's like when painters use the Claude Lorraine glass, they use it as a way to kind of make their eye shift from reality into something else before they commit to canvas. I mean, not every single painter does this, but a lot do. And I think that's not a million miles away from the way in which some artists use the camera on their iPhone or techniques on the iPad or the iPhone or the computer that can transform images in really interesting ways. I think that the technology we're seeing now gives us so many opportunities. In Instagram, you can make a photo look one of, you know, what is it, eight kind of ways, as though you've got your little developing tray and you're in the darkroom. You know, everyone's a photographer. And I think that what technology does is it always pushes artists. So if an artist works with photography and everyone's a photographer, what the hell are you supposed to do? Since some of the photographs are pretty good. And that's right. That's one of the key questions, I think, now, and I think this is what's going on now, is a complete sea change in the photographic image, the image in general, the way people communicate. There's a kind of greater openness and breaking down. I'm really excited about it. I spend most of my time with 20 to 35 year olds, and I'm really, really convinced that this is a major shift that's occurring in the way people are thinking, understanding imagery, and also history. Because I think this is also a very ahistorical period, because the internet really allows you to think about an ancient Roman writer, Shakespeare and Borges in the same breath to a degree that's unprecedented, because it's all there on the page simultaneously and history kind of gets collapsed. And I think it gives you a completely different sense of time. And in a way, since time shifts so fast anyway, whether you want it to or not, it's almost an acknowledgement of that. It's very, very interesting. What's going to happen to history and what's going to happen to art history?
That's a very interesting point. Yeah, what is going to happen with art history? Just yesterday, I was tagged in a Facebook post which said something like, which one of these are million-dollar works of art and which one are yard sale artworks? And then you're sent through a series of questions, which is, they show you Cy Twombly, Clifford Still, a number of different painters, some that I recognize and some that I didn't. And because the scale that you're looking at them is this teeny little image that's all in a rectangular shape, it's kind of hard to tell a Clifford Still from a yard sale painting. And honestly, I got an embarrassing amount wrong. And, I see myself as someone who knows quite a bit about art history. I would like to think that I do. And I thought the internet is reducing everything to this format that's also not what we are used to seeing. And, for example, a museum, a Clifford Still in a museum, is not going to look the same as the yard sale painting, partly because of its scale and size.
Well, again, we're talking about the relationship between what's on a screen, which is information, and the reality of an artwork and real life when you're physically in front of it. And the relationship between seeing something in real life and seeing something in what used to be called reproduction has shifted. So, physical artworks have a very powerful presence, like people do. I think of artworks as people, like people, in terms of their presence, in terms of their what they're saying, the individual quality that each one has, the fact that some are very easy to have an engagement with immediately, others you have to kind of go in and it's quiet or it's gradual. All these kind of things that happen in front of an artwork cannot possibly be experienced or understood or even recognized on the screen. I mean, on the screen, everything's a postage stamp. It's just a tool. You should never buy an artwork from a JPEG. You should never make a judgment about an artwork from a screen. I think that the only thing that there's always good and bad things about shifts that occur in anything, anywhere, for any reason. And in terms of this technological shift, the good thing is that I think it's created an incredible energetic creative openness and has shifted our understanding of time, history, etc. The bad thing is that people think that what's on the internet is true, which it's not half the time, and B, they understand it as something, some kind of reality, when it's not, and it's just something extremely removed from reality. And so it's interesting because I met the man who designed the iPhone, and he said that he's putting in front of his kids paper, pencils, blackboard, chalks. He wants them to have an engagement with physical material process of writing and drawing and, understanding surfaces, physical surfaces. And I thought, wow, that's very interesting, given who he is. And I think it's very, very important that people do not have an ability to recognize the difference between things, that the internet and also commercial forces flatten everything. They flatten music. But if you're listening to some vinyl record on a record player, not for nostalgic reasons, but just because sometimes the quality is better or the experience is different, it's just important to not assume that because everything's been squished into the screen, that's reality. It's not a reality. It's just a tool through which reality is filtered. And so, you know, first of all, it doesn't matter how much something costs. That's just about the comings and goings of, you know, 50 people in the world who are trading artworks like commodities, you know, in Wall Street. And they're just, you know, the prices are absolutely to do with their own bank accounts and not to do with the quality of the art. There are artworks that go to auction for almost nothing that are far more art historically important than whatever it is that some guys decided they want at the time, and then the price will go down later or remain way above what it's actually worth art historically. So price is irrelevant. I mean, it's kind of eye-popping, but it's not important or interesting, except it's interesting that people have so much money when there's so much poverty in the world. But I think that we need to get away from the market thing because it really is, you know, a very, very small number of men just trading with each other. And right. We have to get back to what art really means because, you know, I love looking at the work of young, very, very young artists and seeing where it's going. And you can always tell the ones who are going to trip up because they're too interested in their career, how to make it, what to do to be seen. Their career's already over. It's going to be like a model. You know, it's going to be over in 2 years because, you know, what was interesting in the early part of the early 2000s, for example, 2003, those young artists, where are they now? Goodness knows. So you absolutely cannot have that approach to your art making. You've got to be so ambitious for the work. You've got to really be passionate. And I mean, it's really, it's Darwinistic. It's really, you've got to be incredibly, incredibly ambitious and tough, and you want to be making it and making interesting work and strong work and important work when you're in your 70s, your 80s. You can't be futzing around with whether you get something into the Basel Art Fair. That's totally irrelevant. And so, because guess what? If you really focus on the work and on the ambition for the work, all that other stuff will come anyway. And then when it comes, it's a really dangerous moment, and then you have to keep your balance. Look at Rudy Stingel. He's a fantastic example of someone who worked away and worked away and worked away, and other people were getting much more attention than him, and he just kept on working. And when he finally did the show that we did with him, everyone went, "Oh my God, that's incredible!" And they bought the work, and suddenly the work went up, and da da da. Well, Rudy was surprised and delighted, but he just kept on working and kept on working. And the piece he did, I can hardly call it a piece since it occupied an entire building, the show he did in the Venice Biennale and the Pino Foundation was simply the best thing there. And the fact that he was able to do that, even with all the fuss around him from the market and everything else, is brilliant because he did not take his eye off the ball. So, you know, I think that longevity is something that, with the internet and screens changing things every 2 seconds, you can disappear if you're not careful. So it's actually having a really strong sense of who you are as an artist and as a curator, and at the same time never getting stuck. It's that balance between not getting stuck and moving on and reacting to new things, but not just being like water that'll just evaporate. And that's, in a way, the internet makes us all work harder. Look, the exhibitions used to be things that you did because, partly because people needed to see things that they hadn't seen, and you were the one who were going to show them. You were the one who was going to go around, do the work, see the art, and then bring it to everybody else. Well, now it's at your fingertips on screen, plus there are 500 galleries and 10,000 artists. I mean, where's your role? But that's the same as the artist in a sea of images. That's the same as writers. Now everyone has a blog. So the internet's making all of us work harder. And I think that the standard is really high at the moment for a lot of artists, curators, writers to really say very original things. It's important, however, I think, that getting those things you have to say seen is done in a way that doesn't turn you into your own advertising agency, but that you retain integrity. So it's very tough. It was tough in the 1920s. It was tough in the 1970s. You know, it's always tough. It's just tough in a different way now.
Right. Well, I mean, you were talking earlier about, you know, not to make buy paintings off the internet or judge things by JPEG images. At the same time, you know, with writers, clearly this works. You can exchange writing and have a blog and get interest from writing, which is of great quality, perhaps, on the internet. But with images, though you really can't experience the art as it should be, since this is the way art is shared, and even if you were to do a studio visit or something, isn't often a JPEG or some kind of image what begins to pique your interest towards something, or is there a way around that?
Well, the reason it's different from writing is because it's a material object, and it has a scale, it has a size.
Right.
Some things are 6 inches square, some things are 12 feet. I mean, you know, they operate in physical space, and they have a material presence, and they have a kind of energy, if you like, not to be mystical about it, but they do. They have they exist in physical space, and they're meant to be seen in physical spaces, in collectors' houses, in museums, in different kinds of situations where what they have to say and their presence, which is visual, even if it's using language, it's visual. It's completely different from writing, which is immaterial in that sense. Although, of course, books have their own qualities, depending on, you know, the way they're presented and whether the writer cares about that.
Sure.
Artworks are very... You see, the thing is that the studio you have or the space you have as an artist really helps to determine the way you make your work. So when you come to making your work as a young artist or as an artist in general, you are bringing yourself and your what you have to say together with your physical space in which you're saying it, and who you are and where you're from. I think one of the things that makes New York special is that everyone's from somewhere else and they all collide in this city, and there's a very New York look to paintings, for example. I mean, I went to London for Frieze recently, and I was looking at a collector friend's collection of American painters in his house. It looks so strong. It looked really exhilarating, and I know all those painters quite well. But I see them all the time, and I'm in and out of their studios all the time to look at the work socially. Suddenly to see it removed and in a different country in London, wow, it looked fantastic, and it looked very New York. This was not L.A. painting or Chicago painting. It was very New York. So, you know, the place you're in determines, the city you're in determines to a certain extent the work you make. It's true with every artist. It's true with Picasso, you know, when he was in the Mediterranean. His works had a different quality, you know. The Parisian works, I mean, it's very... You can't get away from that. You can't get away from geography. And then what happens
right.
when people are in a different environment? Then there's the space of the studio itself. You know, there was a moment when German painting was so big, partly because if you go to the Kunstakademie in Düsseldorf, I mean, that, you know, that each studio that the student has, it's like 24 feet high. And that there's a sense of the architecture that German buildings have in art schools and studios. You go to England, you're lucky if you get 12 feet. And on a very banal level, those things also affect the way you're working. There's all kinds of factors.
Right.
So, you know, the environment, and it's how much space you have, whether you need space, you know, whether you work on a small scale or a large scale. None of this is visible on the internet where everything's reduced to images. Not only that, writing on the internet, if you're talking about a blog or a great piece of journalism that someone's blog has produced, or a piece of literature, or I was just Googling the other day, Bazin's What is Cinema essay, there it came instantly. You go to Google Books and you can see, books from the 1930s scanned, and so you can see the texture of the typeface in the original page even. But it's very much easier to retain the integrity of the printed word because it's different from the commercial printed word and the way advertising and commerce uses printed words, which is much more like akin to art. And most of the advertising people trained in art school. Art, when it's on the internet, images have been appropriated for advertising, for the last 150 years. So there's a much more blurry line between the Instagram photograph, the commercial ad, or video, and art. Also because artists are appropriating advertising. So advertising is appropriating art, and art's appropriating advertising. So I think that with all of that, it's much more difficult to see what you're looking at.
Yes.
Which is why you have to have a very clear understanding of the differences and be in studios as much as possible and museums and see things for real.
Right, and not to be too banal, but then what is the role of the JPEG for an artist? Artists, of course, have websites now and send images to get into a studio or to get interested in the work of artists. I mean, you were talking about looking at artists, between 20 and 35 now, yet at the same time, artists, maybe they don't mature till much later. How is
it's not a specific age cutoff. I just meant, I'm in artist studios who are in their 70s as well.
And how do you gain interest? Isn't the role of the JPEG in part to give an inkling of what the work may be, so you could say, that's interesting, or how else?
Sure. The way I come across artists is it's about a community. I mean, New York City is a community of artists. It's a very large community. There are different groups. And I think that those artists cluster around each other socially, around certain alternative spaces, around there are many different gallery scenes, and around art schools. And so what I do is I talk to young artists, and they'll say, I've got five friends. Yeah, they're here, and one's there, and one's there, and one's there. And I'll go, oh, that's great. What's their work like? Oh, it's like this. And maybe they'll show me something from their iPhone. I'll go, interesting. And, I'll go and see them. Or I'll go to an opening in Bushwick, and I'll go to a group show, and I'll look at it. And maybe the group show's not that great, but then maybe it'll be one thing in there that looks really interesting. And then I'll just go to that studio and just take a look. And then I'll go to the galleries in the Lower East Side, and I'll look. And maybe I'll ask to see to go and see a studio of an artist in one of those shows. I teach at Columbia, so I do student crits. I see like six studios a night, Monday nights for it's like eight sessions. It's 48 young artist studios, in a month. I'll talk to them. I'll find out about, some gallery they're all doing collectively or some show they're all in the middle of nowhere, and I'll go, And so someone will then do something. I'm totally open. So on a certain level, when you're doing that kind of work, I'm not just talent spotting. I'm interested in the community. I'm interested in what creates the texture of what's being made now by this community that I'm in the middle of. Obviously, I don't just stay in New York. I also go to LA, and I try and go to other places within a limited travel budget I have. And there's London, and then there's people, there's colleagues will also say, oh, I saw this really interesting artist, or this and this and this. I mean, I went to four things last night, I went to three things the night before. I went. I'm out all the time looking at stuff, and I'm going to the edges of Brooklyn or wherever, because, you know, that's where everything's happening. And if there's an artist who's absolutely retreating from that and hates a scene of any kind and is in their studio working away and very antisocial, there's a certain moment in which you're going to find that artist anyway, because artists want their work to be seen and they want to communicate. So they're going to have to find a way to make that happen. And they want a dialogue with each other. I mean, pretty much all artists I know of every stripe want to talk to each other and have a dialogue and talk about the work and look at each other's work. I mean, that's one of the really exciting things for me, is to actually be with young artists when they're both looking at each other's work and then looking at some big show. I mean, a young artist said to me the other day, so I'm starting work on a very big show for our new building, and he said, you know what makes a really great show? I said, what? He said, when I see it and I come away and I just want to make art. And I thought, wow. Okay, that's probably the biggest compliment anyone could pay a curator, is if a young artist comes out of your show and says, wow, that I want to make art. You know, that show has made me want to go off and do things. You know, that to me is the goal, you know.
Absolutely. That sounds like really what the, and that's the role of museums now, isn't it, to some extent, to generate that kind of energy and excitement, which, I mean, since we are talking about the internet so much and how that figures into life, the museum can create that kind of, you know, tremendous excitement, whereas I look at quite a few images on the internet and it's hard to walk away from it with that kind of experience. And I know that artist experience. I've also had that feeling of, you know, being so energized by a show. And I've interviewed many artists who also come away from shows as even children, thinking, my God, I want to make art. It opens their eyes to a whole new world. So it's, the museum takes an enormously important role now,
It always has done, and I think it's, you know, it's an ecosystem. If you take New York, for example, we've got an incredible number of great museums in this tiny island of Manhattan, let alone the Brooklyn Museum and other, you know, I mean, it's really, there's a very, very, and PS1, there's a very critical mass of incredible shows and collections in this city. And then you have also artist space, White Columns, The Kitchen, you know, these other alternative spaces, and, you know, spaces in Bushwick and little galleries all over the place. And, I mean, they all have a role. I mean, Chelsea Galleries can produce museum-quality shows. I mean, there's an Ad Reinhardt show up at David's Werner at the moment, for example, which is amazing. It's a fantastic show, and worked on by Rob Storr, curated by Rob Storr, and worked on with, you know, Reinhardt's daughter. I mean, it's, you know, top-notch. A gallery can do a show in 3 months. A gallery can go, okay, let's try this, or let's do a group show in the summer and just throw a lot of people together and see what happens. And that's very energizing as well for us, because we can't work that fast, because big institutions, just purely administratively and logistically, we can't move that fast. And also, with us, it's kind of art history in the making, so when something comes into the collection, you can't sell it at auction. It's there for life. So what you bring in can only be a very small amount. We're interested in the top 5-10% of what gets produced, because we can't. That's what we're doing. We're telling the story or stories of American art in the 20th and 21st century. What are those stories, and how can we do it in a succinct but open way that takes into account not just the obvious people, but also gives a very kind of rich, layered story that curators in the future can go into and tell. You know, giving curators in the future tools to tell different stories. I'm always feeling like whenever I buy something for the collection, which is all the time, I'm putting a message in the bottle for curators in the future. So, wow, that's what was really important in 2013. These young artists, or in 1968, you know, if I find something, actually, sometimes that has been buried by art history or by the artist's own career when he moved into painting or whatever. You know, you can pull certain things out, and you're recalibrating art history all the time. And so museums play a really important role, because they can make big important shows that allow you to see a lot of things brought together for the first time, you know, with retrospectives or big group shows. There's so many ways in which they can really bring things to our attention in
Absolutely.
An amazing way. And then the galleries and the galleries and the alternative spaces can do it in a completely different way that's equally energizing, but for different reasons. And so we all work together. There's a dialogue back and forth across. There's a fluidity and an openness to that dialogue that's unprecedented. And I think that's partly because of the internet. So I think that's one of the really positive things about the internet. But at the same time, I think it's important that there's a distinction between the museum and, you know, an alternative space somewhere in the middle of nowhere. Because I think you need also to have a different environment so that it's not the equivalent of iTunes, so that you're not just gathering everything together and homogenizing it.
Absolutely. And you know, you're talking about the role of the museum, which of course is enormously important. And one of the things that you're saying is you're acquiring work, you know, sometimes all the time as kind of messages in a bottle to future curators. What is the process of acquiring work? And is that from young artists, mid-career artists, and older artists? Is it all across the board, or is there a specific spectrum that you're acquiring all the time for these kind of messages in a bottle, which I assume you're meaning they're going into the Whitney's permanent collection. Is that correct?
Yes, it's correct. We're looking at young artists and older artists, everything across the board, and everything from the beginning of the 20th century to work made today. I mean, literally today or yesterday or maybe tomorrow. And the Whitney's always been known for collecting artists very young, when they haven't been proven yet. The biennial is a very important vehicle for that. And I've curated two biennials, and I put very young artists into those biennials and bought them very, very young because I believe in them, and I don't wait for them to be proven. I'm proving it, you know, and I don't sit around and wait for someone else to say yes and anoint them. I see the work and I feel its strength. It should be in the collection. And strong young voices are very clear to me, very clear. And so what happens with the collecting is that we all have responsibility for different acquisition committees. So part of my role, I'm a general curator of contemporary art and 20th century art with a focus on contemporary, and my specialization is film and video because I love that, and I love the relationship between art and film, and I've developed an expertise in that through my passion for it. So when I came to the Whitney, I created an acquisitions committee devoted to that because there wasn't one. And so I've raised all the money, you know, I'm always recruiting new members. And so what I do for my committee, we also have painting and sculpture, prints, drawings, photography. My particular, that's it, I think. Yeah. Mm. My committee deals with film and video, the moving image, in all its forms. So the way I approach it is, okay, we have the 20th century where the moving image, artists were picking up the moving image camera as well as the still camera, but the moving image camera right from the beginning. And some of the earliest experiments were things like multiple screens and, you know, synesthesia and all the rest of it were occurring in Berlin and New York in the mid-20s. So that didn't exist in our collection. That wasn't reflected in our collection. So I bought a few pieces, films and multiple screen film pieces from the mid-1920s. And that's completely shifted our holdings of art in the 20s. So now if you do a permanent collection display, I'm pushing to make sure we have, you know, Oscar Fischinger's triple screen film piece from 1926, which looks like something from the 60s. So I look at the history and try and do that and really shift it and, you know, broaden it. And then I look at it in different ways. I take it by decade. So I think to my, and I'm doing this every day, thinking to myself, okay, like I just saw this film by Rafael Ortiz, this cowboy film from 1957. I had no idea it existed, and called him up and spoke to him for an hour. And it's a wonderful film, and it completely shifts the date where artists were starting to really make films on 16. It shifts it back. Experimental filmmakers and Stan Van Der Beek and others were making them in the late 50s, and Harry Smith. But someone like Rafael Ortiz, this is a really early example. So that shifts it again. So every time you do some research and you see things and you talk to us and you find something else, it shifts the lens again. And so, you know, art history is constantly being rewritten as things occur. So I go decade by decade, partly, and I say, what are the really important things in each decade? And, for example, when I got to the 60s, we didn't have a single film in the collection, and we didn't have any of the obvious videos by Bruce Nauman and all everybody. So I bought all those because we should have them. And also, if we have Richard Serra's sculptures and drawings and prints, why on earth wouldn't we have his films? Why would we leave those out? So there was a lot of catching up just on that level with Joan Jonas, everybody, Carolee Schneeman, that I did just to fill in the very, very obvious gaps. At the same time, I'm very interested in young artists and what they're doing, and I work by young artists, sometimes out of the biennial, sometimes because I see these young artists and I see the work and I think it's very strong. And then I also buy mid-career artists, whether it's, you know, Pierre Weig or Doug Aitken or Kara Walker or, you know, that generation. I've also been buying African-American filmmakers from the 80s and late 70s and 90s. Incredible work. And then young African-American filmmakers. Because the other thing that I've been doing is that, you know, you were talking about the market. I mean, there are two Bruce Nauman installations. One is called Spinning Spheres from 1971, and it's unique. The other is called Art Makeup from 1967, and it's one film in four parts. You can either show as a film or you can show on all four walls. So it's kind of an installation, but it was never editioned. It's a film. Now, one you can buy from Electronic Arts Intermix for a few thousand dollars, and the other is unique, so it's probably worth millions. Well, it's in the Guggenheim's collection. Those two installations are of equal art historical importance, even though one is sort of art world and the other is acquired through film distribution methods, so very inexpensively. So I started buying works for the collection that are films that are very inexpensive, but art historically extremely important. And that was a big shift in the museum because normally we only buy unique works or editioned works. So my argument was, come on, there's only ever going to be a very small number of copies of this avant-garde film in the world ever. It's probably going to be a smaller number than an edition print. And so anyway, we're doing it. And so we have the works of Stan Brakhage, but they don't operate like they do in a film archive. They operate, Stan Brakhage films exist in our collection alongside not only films by artists from the same period, but paintings. It's a very holistic kind of grouping. Everything's together.
So you're mostly acquiring films, though, not so much paintings. You're not.
Well,
my
committee, we acquire painting. We acquire everything, but I'm just talking about my own committee. We buy painting, sculpture, prints, installations, drawings, photography. We buy everything. I'm just talking about my own committee in particular. But with painting and sculpture, we buy young artists and we buy major artists and artists from the past. We also, like all museums, build the collection through gifts, and that's a very important part of what we do. So, for example, if a patron has a very important painting that we want for the collection, we will maybe say to that patron, would you consider giving it to the Whitney as a gift? And a promise gift means that you can enjoy it now, and then when you die, the Whitney takes it, which is a win-win situation. And that's how all museums operate, and in America especially. And, you know, patrons are extraordinarily generous. Museums have always been built through the patronage of private collectors, and their generosity and their vision is extraordinary. And that's
absolutely
very important.
Yeah.
That's a very important part of how museums build the collection.
And it's how important part of artists live. I mean, throughout the ages, patrons have played an important role in artists' lives as well. I'd like to ask you a few questions about how you got into curating. What got you involved after school or during school into the curatorial field?
When I was 12 years old, a friend's mother took us to a friend of hers, studio, who's a painter. And I walked into this artist studio, coming from a background that was not at all, you know, artistic. And I had an instant feeling of familiarity and recognition and pleasure. And I could smell the turpentine, I could see all the paints, I could see the easel, the drawings, the canvases, everything around, and the atmosphere of the studio. And I thought, I just want to be in this space forever. And I went home and I just started looking at books on art, and I decided that I was going to work with artists. That was it. And so I went to study art history, and when I finished, I went to London, and I found an alternative space, an artist studio space near what's now Tate Modern, and there was a gallery in the middle of it that the artists were running. Peter Doig was one of the artists. And I knew nothing. All I had was tons of energy and passion. So I introduced myself and I said to the artist, can I run your space? Can I run your gallery? And I'll raise my salary, my own salary. And they went, sure, okay. So I did. And I had no clue what I was doing. My father gave me a bit of money. I did some freelance secretarial work, and I just ran this space. And
and you raised money for that. You raised money for your salary for this?
Yeah. Yeah.
And how did you do that? Because that's a powerful role and learning curve, I would think, to do it at such a young age.
Well, yeah, I was like 21. Well, what I did was the art world was a lot smaller then. There was a local arts council, and I just went there. It's called Greater London Arts. And I went to the art department. I was very bold. I went to the art department. I just said, will you give me some money to run this space? And they said yes, because they wanted to support artists. There were, I don't know, about 20 artists in this.
It's a nonprofit space. It's something like what we have as artist space or White Columns in New York. Is that correct?
Yeah. But it was a big space, yeah. So one of the shows I did was there was an English band called Wire. And they were working with Brian Eno doing something, and so I did the show with them. It was a huge installation in this huge gallery where they stretched high tension wires from floor to ceiling at different angles, and then you moved through the space and you kind of touched each wire, and it was almost like playing an instrument, and the entire room became like an instrument, and people moved through it going dung 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 dung. And it was semi-dark and probably totally dangerous.
I love that.
But yeah, so that was the show I did. And then I went to Nick Sirota, who was at the time running the Whitechapel Art Gallery, and I said, I'm just starting out. And amazingly, he took my call. You know, he agreed to see me. And because the art world was much more informal and small then. And I said, I'm just starting out, and I wondered if you could give me some advice. So he said, my advice to you is just take risks, because I can't take risks anymore. Just try things and take risks and experiment and follow your instincts. And so I did. And that's how I started.
And what was the next step? So this is in London, and that was after undergraduate school, correct?
Yeah. So in England, you don't go to grad school unless you're going to teach, because the first degree is a pretty good degree, and that's, you know, the standard's pretty high, and you don't get a second degree unless you're going into academia. Well, certainly that was the case when I was there. But what happened after that was the building needed to close because we only had the building for a particular amount of time, and the local council, London Council, owned it, and they wanted to take it back, knock it down, and build old people's homes or something. So we had to leave. So everyone dispersed, and I started working for an artist curator called Robin Klasnick at Matt's Gallery at 10 Martello Street, which is an artist studio complex in East London. And what was very, very particular at that moment about the art scene in London was that after the Second World War, there was so much bombing of the East End, because that's where the docks were, that there was a lot of kind of abandoned houses and old buildings, and so artists took them over, and there were money was given to these spaces. So this is a big studio complex, and Robin had a studio there, and he decided to turn it into a gallery. And the gallery would be different from most galleries in that instead of installing for 2 weeks and opening for a couple of months, he would have the artist in there for 2 or 3 months and open for a couple of weeks. So turn the space into the artist studio over an extended period and do something that give the artist something no one else could. And then you'd come for a very short period to see the result. So he was looking for an assistant. I applied and got it. And he taught me an incredible amount. He once spent 3 days lighting one painting, one big painting, to get it right. Nothing was too much. What the artist said went. Nothing was too much trouble. And he taught me to put the artist first. He taught me to work with the artist in a very direct way and to not be institutional in any way in terms of, you know, the approach to how you made the show. It had to be, it was very direct. Mm-hmm. And so I worked with him, and what happened was he would invite the artist, and he would send the invitations out. The artist would work in the space for 2 or 3 months. He'd send the invitations out. People would come. I had to let in everyone personally. They'd ring the doorbell. I'd go downstairs. I'd take them upstairs. I'd hand them the little statement about the show. I'd walk them sometimes around the show or sit there in the room while they went to see the show. They'd come out. They'd talk about it. It was a very personal. It was like letting someone into your living room, and it was like a studio almost, but it was a show. It was a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant format, and for a while, it was one of the most important spaces in London. And he taught me everything I knew. He taught me how to be in a physical space and how to react to what the artist wanted to do and how the artist wanted to transform in that physical space, because they were. He said, you can do anything. You can cut a wall down. You can take the windows out. You can't knock down the ceiling because the building would fall down. You can do anything else, you know. And they did. And so everything was possible. It was very different from a museum situation. It was incredibly open and experimental in a physical way. And so I did that. And then after a certain moment, I thought, I really want to work in a museum, because I now want to bring what I know to a museum situation and shift the museum, shift the way they think, and also be engaged in a dialogue in a very major way. So I applied for a job at the Museum of Modern Art in Oxford, and I got it. And I did a site-specific sculpture there. I just started doing shows, and John Latham's first retrospective, which was really amazing to work with him. Yoko Ono, Marina Abramovich's first retrospective, and a big performance by her and a whole big show. I mean, I just started going crazy, and I had the most amazing director who allowed me to do almost anything. He never said no. And he was a radical thinker and an incredible intellectual and very, very supportive. And when I wrote my first catalogue essay, we shared the same room. He didn't even have a separate office. He said, come here, and he sat me next to him. He said, this is crap, this is really good, you're taking this far too seriously, Duchamp never thought like that, blah, 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 blah. And he critiqued my catalogue essay, this is great, now go and rewrite. And he was very pedagogical, and we were right in the middle of Oxford, so he'd say, okay, Baudrillard's at the French Institute, I just heard, so put down your pen, let's go over and see him. So we just put down our pens, walk over, say hi to Baudrillard, hear him lecture, and then walk back to work. Mm. I would say, oh, okay, Umberto Eco's here now. Let's go and have a look at him at the Sheldonian. I go, okay. So we, the two of us, will walk over, and I mean, and then Lichtenstein would come to do his show, and he took me out to lunch with Lichtenstein. He didn't leave me at home behind my desk because I was the kid. I was the young curate. He brought me with him. So he was quite extraordinary. And then from there, I came to the Whitney.
And now that you've been at the Whitney quite a while, and this is really where you've built your career and written more
yeah.
books and developed
yeah.
an approach. Chrissy, it's been wonderful talking to you today. I'm really grateful for this conversation. And in closing, artists are listening to this who are not just younger artists, mid-career artists, older artists, and they're learning a lot as I have from everything you've said. Is there anything in particular you want to leave them with concerning studio practice or an approach to work? Because, of course, they're thinking, yeah, it would be wonderful to be in a museum or to be acquired or all of these things that perhaps, you know, they should or should not be thinking at certain points in their career. You don't have to touch on those things, but is there anything in particular you want to say to those listening?
Well, I think if you're making important work, it will always get found sooner or later. It might get found next week, 5 years' time, 30 years' time, or way beyond our lifetime. But if you're making important work, believe me, somebody will find it sooner or later. It's just the way it works. Some careers proceed in a very kind of linear way. And, you know, there are career artists, if you like, who do really well within the system, and they go right from beginning to end, and it's very sort of fast track. There are other artists who do incredibly well with collectors, and museums don't take them seriously. There are other artists who museums take incredibly seriously, who collectors have no interest in. There are other artists who get discovered at the age of 60, or get rediscovered at the age of 70 or 50. There are artists who are 25 and they have the darling for 5 years, and then they drop off the dial. It's a very open, fluid system, and there is no single formula for success except the greatness of your work. Because after the hot air and the blah blah dies down, and after none of us are here anymore, the only thing that survives is the art, and the art has to speak for itself on the wall or standing in the middle of the gallery for the next 500 years. And as long as that's at the forefront of everything you do, that's the only thing that matters.
Chrissy, thank you so much for talking with us today. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Likewise, thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.